So I would very much like to join you in person. Unfortunately, this time I cannot due to a family constraint. I really hope in near future we can really see and hug each other and catch up. So dense hydrogen, this is the topic we picked up actually about a year and a half ago. So I would like to tell you about our thinking and our progress. So first about the problem. So hydrogen is actually the most abundant element in the visible universe. So meaning if you randomly grab a piece of matter, probably not on Earth, but somewhere in the universe, with high chance it's going to be hydrogen. In particular, the state of matter I'm focusing in particular in this talk. So roughly speaking, in the two-dimensional phase diagram of the hydrogen, so in terms of the temperature and the pressure, so there are kind of three regimes. For sufficiently high temperature, the system is in a plasma phase with ionized protons and electrons. Then if you go down in temperature, it's going to be a liquid. However, it can either be liquid of hydrogen atoms or a liquid of hydrogen molecules. There might be a phase transition between the two. Then if you go further down in temperature, it's going to form a crystal with different possible crystal structures. And some of these crystals will be conducting or even superconducting. So that's a sketch of the kind of a phase diagram. And the equation of state and all kinds of phases of dense hydrogen is going to be relevant both for things in the sky and in the lab on Earth. For example, if you manage to travel from the surface all the way to the core of a giant planet like Jupiter, you are going to find yourself following the adiabatic path in that two-dimensional phase diagram. So you are going to possibly pass through a few phase boundaries, if there is any phase boundary. And for laser-induced fusion experiment, essentially people shed the laser to hydrogen isotopes. And to understand such a physical process, people typically run hydrodynamic simulations. But for those kind of simulation, an essential input is actually the equation of state for dense hydrogen. So probably the thing on this slide is the most intriguing features that people care about such systems. Because for kind of various reasons, right, like iron mass and higher density and so on. So according to the conventional BCS theory, so the metallic hydrogen phase is predicted to have very high superconducting transition temperature. And the ab initio simulation of the system actually confirms the prediction. You see, it can easily reach room temperature at sufficiently high pressure. So then this has become some kind of a holy grail for high pressure physics. People try to compress the matter in laboratory, trying to reach metallic hydrogen and to detect possible superconducting phase. There are actually recent controversies about around it. Even though we believe somewhere in the space, such a matter has to exist. But unfortunately, at the moment on Earth, probably this has not been reached. So this is also a starting point for people thinking about putting other elements into the system, think about hydro and chemical compression and so on. But this is also not the end of the story, because besides such a conventional BCS and type of superconductor, there might also be all kinds of exotic phases. For example, there might be superconductor with no crystal structure, where the protons are still in their liquid phase. And there can even be the Cooper pairs between protons on top of the Cooper pairs between electrons. So those are quite fascinating possibilities in such a simple systems. So this is a dense hydrogen. You see, it's a very clean and simple systems. Imagine you have a box, periodic box, and put n electrons and n protons into it. That's it. On the other hand, this is also a quite fascinating, also challenging quantum many-body system. For this reason, this has become a touchstone of computational method. So you have to solve the thing with sufficiently high accuracy to get all the physics right. So for all kinds of reasons, all these reasons, I love the systems like many of my colleagues. And one of the earliest many-body calculation for dense hydrogen systems is what was this one. It was done by David Sapley and Bernie Arder. So this is more or less right after they finished their famous uniform electron gas calculation, which was later used in all these local density functionals. But they move on to hydrogen partially because they believe this is an actual material rather than an idealized model system. And what they did was a ground state calculation for fixed proton lattice, fixed to be a FCC lattice, and they got ground state energy prediction. And according to this interview with David Stapley, they were actually quite proud for this very early many electron calculation for such a realistic material. And fast forward to today, actually quite recently, people revisited some of those ground state calculations. For example, that's a quite a recent calculation from the Siemens collaboration on many electron problems, where they consider a fictitious one-dimensional hydrogen chain and benchmarked a number of numerical methods for such a system. But on top of that, there is also a variational Monte Carlo calculation done by DeepMind and collaborators. So you see, their variational ansatz, the so-called FermiNet, which is an anti-symmetrized neural network as a variational wave function, actually get quite accurate result compared to some of the best methods in the Siemens Mellon electron collaboration. So this is a ground state calculation for fixed proton configurations. So in the other end of the spectrum, so at sufficiently high temperature, people can do path integral Monte Carlo. So essentially this maps the quantum system into a kind of a classical ring polymer system. And this method treats electrons and protons on an equal footing. But due to quite intrinsic and infamous Fermi sign problem, so this kind of approach was limited to high temperature and the low density regime. So more or less cover this corner of the phase diagram. So you see ground state calculation is somewhere here, passing from the column calculation was somewhere here. So this two methods adding together still left a large portion of the phase diagram untouched. But that's also where many of the interesting things was happening. So for those part of the phase diagram, so it's useful to think the system, which consists of electrons and protons, as a quantum classical coupled system. So here the classical degree freedom is a proton configuration or proton coordinate. And for a given proton coordinate, you can solve the electronic ground state problem that gives you the energy for a given proton configuration. So this is something called the Born-Oppenheimer energy surface. So in this regard, you can break the problem into two pieces. So for given proton configuration, you need a kind of a very efficient and accurate Manning electron solver that gives you the ground state energy. So it has to be efficient because you see it's going to be something you make use of many times repeatedly because it's going to be in the inner loop, right? Because later on, you need to also move the proton configurations. They are classical degree of freedom. You can move them with classical Monte Carlo or molecular dynamics. But here, the tricky thing was, suppose you use some of the most accurate many-body solvers, for example, quantum Monte Carlo or variational Monte Carlo, you are going to get noisy estimate for the energies, for the Born-Oppenheimer energy surfaces. And we all know this is a famous Metropolis kind of acceptance ratio. When you move proton coordinate a little bit, how much do you want to accept the move, right? But if you try to do that with noisy energy estimate, it's going to be a tricky business to make sure you still sample proton configuration unbiasedly. So there are ways of doing that, but it's quite tricky to make sure it's still efficient and unbiased. So this coupled with many other kind of conventional difficulties like finite size effect and the ergodicity issue of Monte Carlo sampling make this part of the phase diagram kind of controversial. So for example, in this regime, that's where the atomic liquid to molecular liquid phase transition happens. And considering this phase boundary, there are actually many predictions. So those two are ab initio molecular dynamic simulation with different density functionals, where naturally they differ a little bit. Okay, by a few gigapascal in the phase drop boundary. And those two are essentially the same kind of method that treats protons and electrons as a coupled system, but they differ a lot. Probably because of this kind of uncertainties in the sampling, or probably because many of other issues. Okay, so have machine learning offer a help here. So one of the quite predominant and popular machine learning approach for such kind of system was so-called machine learning potential. So essentially the idea is to fit the Born-Oppenheimer energy surface with a machine learning model, for example, a neural network like that. Then because the inference of such a neural network is going to be much more efficient than any of those like many electron solvers, okay, even much faster than DFT. So that means later on when you use this surrogate model to sample proton configuration, you can easily reach larger system and collect more samples. Or in MD, molecular dynamics language, you can go to much longer simulation time. But naturally, as you can see, so as a surrogate model, the accuracy of machine learning potential is still limited by their training data, DFT, all kinds of Monte Carlo method. So that means in along this line, machine learning offers a way to increase the simulation efficiency, but that it probably does not improve accuracy. And sometimes it can even you may even lose accuracy because in the fitting all kinds of things can happen. For example, the there might be issue with generalizability and so on. So that means in this direction, when you apply machine learning in this way, it may or may not address the actual difficulty around the controversial issue of liquid-liquid phase transition. So for example, here is an example. People indeed applied the machine learning potential to such a dense hydrogen system and studied the liquid-liquid phase transition. So even though for very long time, people believe that phase transition is actually first order, the debate was more or less all around this question, like where is the transition point? However, when, for example, this paper employed machine learning potential, they actually found out qualitatively different results for the phase transition, because suddenly for machine learning trained potential, they obtained a continuous phase transition. But later on, this result was again get questioned by other people that brute forcefully push ab initio molecular dynamics simulation for much larger system and longer time, so they can match the machine learning simulation time. So this is an example that simply use machine learning kind of theoretical model in such kind of simulation may not address the actual difficulty, so resolve some of the debate. And to really resolve the issue, I think the best hope along this direction was doing something called data machine learning. So essentially, instead of fitting the total energy, because probably this is too difficult for all kinds of neural networks, because there might be all kinds of singular behavior and so on. The data was not sufficient. So people try to fit the difference of the total energy with DFT predictions. So that's why this is called delta. So this delta correction is expected to be small and smooth. So that it should be much easier to learn. So for example, in an ideal case, so if you can make use of different density functionals in the calculation, they naturally get different predictions. But if you really do it carefully and do it in a right way, you can correct correct from different reference point and get a converged result. This is really an ideal case. And people were hoping that along this direction, you can really resolve all the mystery around the phase diagram in hydrogen and also in other systems. So this is the kind of a status for the simulation method and its relation to machine learning to dense hydrogen systems. And in the following kind of a part of the talk, I'm going to tell you something different. So we try to again study the problem with machine learning based simulation tools. However, we were thinking about something different. Probably we didn't have the opportunity to push the simulation to much larger system, but we tried to make it more principled, try to resolve many of the ambiguity in the method so you can increase the accuracy of the whole framework. And the thing we try to achieve is based on something called the variational free energy principle. So it's basically this objective function for a classical statistical mechanics problem. So suppose you are given energy function, okay, energy as a function of coordinate. So instead of solving that with Monte Carlo method, you can actually try to solve the whole the system with by minimizing such a variational free energy objective. This is the entropy of your variational density. So variational density is a kind of a probability distribution you guessed for the target distribution. And this is the energy function. So you can show that this is objective function is lower bounded by the true free energy of the system. And the equality holds when the variational probability distribution match the true Boltzmann distribution. So this is the basic framework we try to follow. And notice that in this way of solving problem, if you have additive noise on the energy function, it does not immediately cause trouble for such a variational minimization, because since we are doing stochastic minimization or optimization for such an objective anyway, so adding some noise, unbiased static noise here, it does not really kill me immediately. This it should be compared with noise on the shoulder of exponential when you do Majapolis Hastings kind of acceptance. This is different. So another high-level comment was when you're trying to solve a classical static problem in this way, so you are treating a sampling problem into an optimization problem. So in principle, this does not mean the problem becomes easier, because you can easily get trapped into a local minima and so on. But on the other hand, from a technical point of view, turning the sampling problem into an optimization problem makes it easier to leverage deep learning engine. By those engines, I mean differentiable programming tools and all those specialized hardware like GPU and TPUs. So this is the kind of a basic principle we try to follow, right? So it's not Monte Carlo or molecular dynamics simulation, but some kind of a variational free energy principle. So this is also a good point to compare with ground state variational calculations that has been already mentioned in this conference. So this is the standard variational Monte Carlo calculation for quantum systems at the ground state at zero temperature. So where you sample from wave function modular square and evaluate something called the local energy, while here you sample from the variational probability density and you evaluate something the free energy that consists of energy and entropy. So you see, you can treat both as some kind of variational Monte Carlo. Probably this was like more unfamiliar to you. That's actually right, because that's that was not fully explored for the reason that I'm going to explain in a bit. So in ground state calculation, in principle, you can invent any kind of neural network ansatz as a rational ansatz, if as long as it respects all kinds of physical symmetry you care about. So the wave function ansatz does not need to be normalized, because the normalization factor cancels here. And if you sample them with Majapolis, you do not care about normalization. But in the finite temperature rational free energy calculation, it's different. Because there is the entropy term, you have to pay attention to the normalization factor of your probability distribution, because otherwise you cannot easily evaluate entropy term. So to make this even more clear, let's imagine we kind of try to parameterize our variational probability density as another Boltzmann distribution, right? So by the way, if you do that, you are actually inventing your own generative model called Boltzmann machine, because Boltzmann machine is essentially this kind of idea, right? Expressing probability distribution as a Boltzmann distribution. So people also call this energy-based model. Right? But if you plug these variational ansatz into the objective, you are going to see this, it's going to turn into this form. This is actually quite familiar from Feynman's book and many other places. So the thing was, there is, again, this intractable normalization factor of your variational Boltzmann distribution that appears. If you cannot evaluate this term easily, you cannot carry out the variational optimization. So this actually causes kind of a dilemma, because very often people try to invent rich, flexible variational ansatz, variational probability distribution for the variational free energy calculation. But on the other hand, they also need to have a way to compute this partition function. So very often this is not easy. But the modern generative model offers a solution to that, because as we're going to see in a minute, many of the modern generative models had a tractable normalization factor. Tractable means it's something easy to compute, okay? On top of that, many of those generative models also support direct sampling. That means you can really get samples directly, like those child throwing stones in the rectangular, right? There's no Markov chain to talk about. So here are two examples of those class of generative models. On the left is called the autoregressive model. Basically, you factorize your variational density into a long chain of probability distributions. So those language models like GPT was working exactly in the same way. So for each factor, you predict only one token or one word probability. So in that sense, each factor is easy to normalize. Then the whole thing is also normalized. And to sample from this high dimensional distribution is also easy. You sample just one by one, okay? And on the right is my favorite generative model. It's called the normalizing flow. So it starts from something called the base distribution. It's something easy to sample and also normalized. For example, normal distribution for something called the latent variable Z. Then you carry out a change of variable from Z to X. So in this way, you parameterize a high dimensional flexible probability distribution using a transformation. So by tuning such a transformation, you can tune this variational density. So from this expression, it's also easy to say that you can directly sample from this distribution. Also, it's automatically normalized. So in this way, modern generative models offers a gift to rational energy principle. It actually unlocks its power. It's also kind of the other side of the coin in terms of the applications, because for those variational free energy calculation, what was known was that energy function, right? It's an analytical expression, or let's say something you can evaluate, right? Given the classical coordinate, you can evaluate the function. And what was unknown was the samples from the Boltzmann distribution related to that energy function. And in the standard applications of those generative models, So what was known was samples. So because, for example, all those images or text, the people already collect all those samples from nature. And what was unknown was the underlying generating probability distribution for those samples. So that's why in these two different scenarios, people are learning from different things. So in a rational free energy case, people learn from the Hamiltonian or the energy function, while in the standard generative modeling scenario, people learn from data. And there are two sides of the same coin in the sense they're actually minimizing same kind of objective function, something called Kubrick-Leibler divergence. So in the learn from Hamiltonian case, you put your variational density in the front, while in the learn from data scenario, you put your variational density in the bottom and try to match that with the data empirical distributions. And there are actually pros and cons of different approaches. For example, in variational free energy case, typically the variational density will be narrower than the true distribution. That actually corresponds to a local minima in the variational free energy, okay? While in the learn from data scenario, typically the model density will be wider than the true distribution. That again may cause problem, something called a hallucination. Some, for example, from language model, you can get nonsense or inaccurate description that appears to be true. So GPT was trained, at least the base model of GPT was trained, use maximum likelihood on data. So very naturally, that if you view its ability as a distribution, it's going to be broader than the whole collection of in training data. So imagine the distribution of one human expert is like this peaky, very sharp distribution. You collect all the things. That's a collective distribution of human knowledge. And the distribution of GPT will be even broader. So in this sense, it's a rather general model. So some people call that it's a jack of all trades, but master of none. From my daily experience of with such a model, I also had this feeling. So it at least in the at the moment fills the gap of human knowledge rather than pushing the boundary of it. So coming back to hydrogen, so this is our variational free energy objective function. So you might recognize this piece is a standard ground state calculation. So except there's again a variable x is the proton distribution, a proton coordinate that was get sampled from the variational density. And related to that, there's a proton entropy, right? On top of the energy. So that combined together gives you free energy. So then there are two models in this variational objective. One thing is a normal thing flow for the proton distribution. The other thing is a neural network for the electron ground state wave function given proton coordinate. So we need to jointly optimize these two neural networks so that we get a minimum value for the free energy. So the other thing to notice that this is indeed a joint optimization rather than like by level things. Because in the Monte Carlo scenario, in the coupled ion electron Monte Carlo scenario, so it was like you need to carry out variational Monte Carlo optimization as an inner loop so that you stay on top of the Born-Oppenheimer energy surface. So you have to, for each proton move, carry out variational optimization to the optimum. So you move the such that you can move the proton a little bit, then you carry out another level of variational Monte Carlo calculation. So here it's joint optimization. You just move everything together. Okay. So let me explain these two components one by one. First one is the normalization flow for the proton distribution. So this is a flow. So except at the moment we are thinking about the particles in a periodic box. So here it's not normal distribution rather than uniform distribution. And from the latent variable Z to the physical variable X, there is an invertible equivalent neural network carries out the change of variable between the two. And the way to visualize it, I tend to think proton coordinates are some kind of actual particle, while those latent variable, I view them as a quasi particle. And very naturally, a way and kind of invertible equivalent neural network to connect the two has a ResNet kind of a composition of ResNet kind of a structure. And to build up some physical intuition for normalization flow, we can think about some two variable toy problem. For example, coupled harmonic oscillator. So the distribution for a coupled harmonic oscillator was actually a Gaussian distribution, but it was like a tilted because these two variables has correlation. Where we can imagine some kind of invertible neural network that decouples these two variables and turn the distribution into an isotropic normal distribution. So this is what a normalization flow is trying to achieve. But in physics language, this was nothing but a normal mode decomposition, right? You separate these two degrees of freedom into central mass and relative motion. Actually, for harmonic oscillator, this was like even a linear transformation. Using a neural network is clearly a overkill. However, you get the idea. Normalizing flow is an extension of this idea. It's a high-dimensional, nonlinear, and a composable learnable transformation between variables so that by tuning the transformation, you can tune variational density. So this is normalizing flow. In case you are interested, it actually find many applications in physics. You can check those papers. So the second component is a wave function for given proton coordinate. And we set it up in terms of the geminal type. So geminal is this kind of a pairing wave function. And it has been long understood that such a wave function structure can capture atomic, molecular, and even superconducting state. And here the twist was nowadays, right? It's like deep learning age. You can set up geminal kind of a wave function using deep neural networks by borrowing many of the building blocks from Fermilab, from graph neural network, massive passing neural network, something like that. So essentially, you need the crucial component was you need to extract certain feature, equivalent features from proton and spin up, spin down coordinate. Once you have this feature, you just assemble those features into such a structure. You can make sure such a wave function satisfy all the symmetry properties. So that's a thing for equivalent, okay? And this is a like benchmark for fixed proton position arranged to be a BCC lattice. And this was compared with more conventional variational calculation without neural networks. I mean, it's not surprising nowadays with neural networks, you can kind of get lower energies, but this at least tests the quality of the wave function we are using in as a component in the framework. And this is then the first physical result we obtained. So remember this two-dimensional phase diagram in terms of temperature and pressure. So in the center, somewhere here, there is this particular point. that's also the only parameter point in the literature where we can find published value for free energy. Because for all kinds of more conventional methods, it's not that easy to compute free energy. You see, typically in Monte Carlo, you can simply estimate many of the observables, but to calculate free energy or entropy, you need to carry out a thermodynamic integration or one-order. So this paper carried out a two-stage thermodynamic integration by connecting hydrogen to Ikawa gas to ideal gas, so they can get absolute free energy for this point. And since we are doing variational free energy calculation, so this is a good baseline, or let's say benchmark for us. So that's why we start with this point. And this red line is our value. So you see, as a training, the loss function goes down. Remember, this is a variational calculation. There is no overfitting. Lower is always better. But in the end, our free energy is still slightly higher than their value. There are a few possible reasons. Probably we are not doing good enough. Optimization needs to be improved. The flow needs to be improved. The wave function needs to be improved. That's the thing on our side. All the other reason might be that these values from the thermodynamic integration was not variational, because it's not a variational kind of calculation, right? It's like connecting many of the things. But nevertheless, it's like a few millihertz difference. And as a function of optimization, also the proton correlation function develops this kind of shape. Remember, initially it's all uniform, rather uninformative kind of a starting point. And once you have the variational probability distribution for proton and for variational wave function for the electrons, you can then extract all kinds of physical observable, for example, energy, entropy, pressure. This gives you equation of state of the system, of the dense hydrogen. So here are some reference. Blue thing is some kind of a empirical phenomenological model that astrophysicists was making use of. Red thing is ab initio molecular dynamics with DFT. So the black line is a couple electron ion Monte Carlo. So this nested Monte Carlo calculations. So our predicted, our pretend pressure is even lower than this supposed to be the most accurate value. So that means we predict an even denser equation of state compared to all the previous methods. So at the moment, I'm not sure whether our prediction is indeed more accurate or not, because the variational free energy was not good enough. But the one thing I'm pretty confident was this prediction can be systematically improved by lowering the variational free energy, because there's a gold standard for this kind of variational calculations. And the other good thing was this is looks like a random point in the center, but this value was already kind of directly relevant for planet modeling, because from the surface to the core in Jupiter, it has to pass through that point, okay? And for this application, having access to entropy is actually very, very common. Since they have to use entropy to constrain the curve. And on the other hand, that point in the phase diagram is an interesting point, because there's no phase transition. This was like close to the plasma phase. It's a soup of protons, electrons, and hydrogen atoms, and there's no fancy physics. So to look for fancy physics, you have to either go up or go down in temperature. And we're going to mention these things in the following. Go forward, starting from this, I think, very kind of a vanilla kind of implementation, there are still many, a few things you can improve. For example, one thing is this rather uninformative uniform base distribution, right? Assuming that the latent variable are just a random uniform distribution. That actually is automatically normalized, and that enables us to compute the absolute variational free energy. But this is a very bad, I would say, starting point, because initially all those protons are very close. They are so close that fusion is possible, but that's another matter. So a thing that makes sense is, of course, to inject certain physical knowledges into the flow. For example, you can make use of those kind of machine learning potential, put those potential here. They have their own normalization factor, right? This is normalized density, and keep them fixed, then train the kind of a transformation from this latent variable. So in this way, once you put the equation, put that into the equation, I'm going to say, you are, in some sense, learning the correction to these machine learning potentials, right? So this is a variational Monte Carlo energy estimate. This is a machine learning potential energy estimate. You are looking at their difference. And this is a null, but a fixed constant, that is the partition function given by these models. So in that sense, you are optimizing a free energy difference to a much better starting point, okay? So here are some very preliminary results. So deep MD is a very popular models, and but it has its potential shortcoming, because it has to be tied with some certain kind of training data, for example, PBE functionals. That's a density functional, right? And you do not know whether that's really accurate or not, sufficiently accurate or not. And start from that point. Once you learn the correction, you are going to see that the proton-proton distribution is going to shift from the reference point. I hope this reminds you a little bit of this data machine learning story, right? Starting from different reference point. If you do things right, you will get converged answer. And to my taste, doing this kind of a correction in a variational free energy framework is more elegant and more controlled than the staged approach like data machine learning. And I mentioned going down in temperature. One of the fascinating topic was a quantum proton effect, nuclear quantum effect. And because of the light list of the hydrogen atoms, the proton, and this quantum nuclear quantum effect was also essential for studying superconducting phase in an ab initio way. And there is actually a way to treat those systems. Remember, we are talking about a quantum proton, so that the whole variational free energy framework has to be promoted or extended to a variational density matrix formalism. And luckily, this was possible, and we'll work out some ways of doing that, again, by constructing variational density matrices using deep journey models. This time there's like square root of normalizing flows and transformers and so on. And hope in future we can make use of this technique to study the really, really interesting portion of the phase diagram of dense hydrogen. And I would like to end this talk by showing this slide from Demis Hassabis. So he was talking about what are the suitable problems to AI in science. So he was listing three criteria. So massive combinatorial search space, and a clear objective function, and then either lots of data or an efficient and accurate simulator. And I would say variational free energy calculation of dense hydrogen using deep journey models satisfies all three criteria. So for this reason, I'm really looking forward to uncover some of the mystery of nature in this line of research. So that's my collaborators and references. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Lei Wong, for a wonderful talk. Time for questions. You catch this? Take it from Steph.
Thanks a lot. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. I might have two questions. The first one, you were showing the phase diagram and with a lot of uncertainties. Isn't there just experiments on that?
Sure.
Or why are there no experiments that clarified phase transitions?
Yeah. There are experiments like diamond emissaries, shock waves, all kinds of experiments. If I plot experiments on top of those phase diagram, you are going to see actually similar trends because the uncertainties in those high pressure experiments is also quite high. So that's why even combined with the experiment, we are not really freaking out the truth of nature.
Okay, so like they're just not as accurate enough, the experiments, or to make predictions. Okay, I understand. And maybe a second question, if I may. Okay, perfect. And the second question is that you were treating, and also others were treating, the protons and electrons on different footing, in the sense that, like, for the electrons, you were searching for ground states, and the distribution of the protons, you were treating with at finite temperature. Could you explain maybe why this is a suitable approach and why this is accurate enough?
All right.
Because why do they have different temperatures?
Yeah, right. Because there is a massive difference in the mass of the two things. So in that sense, if you choose the whole thing, in principle, they are all fermions, but their Fermi temperature differs by a factor of like 10,000. That's why if your temperature was sitting there, then compared to the fermionic Fermi temperature, it's essentially zero temperature for fermions. However, on the other hand, the temperature is much higher than the Fermi temperature of protons. That means protons behave like classical particles. It was because of the huge separation between their energy scales. Yeah.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Questions?
Thanks. Hi, Eliska here. I have a naive question. So in this normal neural network VMC settings, like, people realize that the symmetries are the really crucial thing that you need to optimize. Like, how can you talk about a bit, how does that translate into this probability distribution? Do you have like a simple tools to enforce symmetries, and how does that influence your optimization then?
Right. So it really matters. And all those symmetry related discussion was hidden in this word equivalent. And here, since it's in a continuous space, but I think on Monday there was also related talk in continuous space that different. I think it's a similar kind of discussions. So it's a theoretical system. And then you need to care about the permutation permutation invariant of the probability, right? Because if you permute two protons, you get the same distribution, okay? Then if you translate proton by one box length, it's the same probability. And you need to build in all those symmetries into the answers And the way to building those things in was to consider an equivalent transformation. It's all hidden here. So, to my experience, actually, we never tried to break these symmetries because once you break this symmetry, the rational answers would be not that physical. Yeah. So that's for the proton part. And then for the electron parts, it's again, similar kind of discussion. So make sure it's a permutational anti-symmetries and things like that. Again, this was hidden here, equivalent, yeah.
Yeah, super clear, thank you.
Hi. Related to the phase diagram, the liquid-liquid transition, what symmetry is changing there? Is that related to like the liquid-liquid transition in water? And if so, like how?
Okay, it's actually similar. So there's no, it's not a symmetry breaking phase transition. It's a H2 to H. So it means it's a like a binding of two hydrogen molecules. Two hydrogen atoms into a molecule. So again, for this reason, people strongly believe, and also numerical simulations, many of the numerical simulations show this is actually the first order phase transition. So that's why it's not like symmetry breaking kind of continuous phase transition. Yeah,
okay.
That's a big.
Thank you.
Hi, thanks a lot for the great talk. I just wanted to ask you about the last point you were making about the quantum case. Yeah, on your last slide, basically. I think it was your last slide. When you were talking about density matrices, basically. So if you use some kind of variational ansatz for the density matrix, what ideas do you have to deal with the log of a density matrix?
Right. So, So the way we parameterize this density matrix was actually starting from simple reference quantum state, then apply unitary transformations to it. So, inside this log thing, all this unitary operator will cancel. So in the end, for this kind of variational ansatz, let's say, if psi, there are also normal many electron bases, then you can actually figure out that trace rho log rho equals to summation over p log p. So that means you can directly evaluate entropy of this quantum density matrices by looking at those values. So unitarity was a kind of a solution to your question. It was related to the square root here. I hope this was clear enough. Yeah.
It is. Thank you.
I wanted to ask you what applications of your method that you are most excited about. You mentioned near the beginning, like motivation for your talk, use of deuterium and fusion reactors, for example, and that's really exciting. Do you see these methods as providing any leg up or benefit to folks who are working on those sorts of experiments?
At the moment, I'm not sure. For me, at the moment, one of the most exciting probability was somewhere here, liquid superconductors. Because I think if we had the ability to treat quantum protons, there would be some opportunity for us to study, to obtain superconducting state in a fully ab initio way. So personally, for me, this is the most problem. exciting potential application. And for fusion, I don't know. They're bottleneck. Even though I say equation of state is an essential point, but I'm not sure about the bottleneck. That are something that we equation of state or related stuff we can compute, but I'm not sure whether this was indeed an open question. Whether, for example, DFT was really not enough. Okay.
Thank you.
Maybe if I may, I can take the final question. Lei Wang, can you show your slide again where you had JAX and the GPU?
Oh,
halfway,
okay.
Like halfway through your talk.
Somewhere.
That one's also good too, but I think it was before this one. It was the idea about replacing sampling, you know, with optimization, right? Right.
Right.
I feel this is really kind of a powerful perspective that, you know, is germane to this, the point of many talks in this conference. So when you turn a sampling problem to an optimization problem, I guess my question is, you know, are there any other really promising, I guess, applications of this idea that all the young folks in the audience should be thinking about? So, you know, where many of us maybe are used to sampling problems, is there something that sticks out in your mind? You know, that now that we have automatic differentiation and differentiable programming tools and all this type of stuff, is there anything, you know, that we should be thinking about transferring from a sampling problem to an optimization problem? Any ripe fruit for the picking in your mind?
But I guess I only had an answer, but it's from on the flip side. That the idea was to turn the thing to the optimization problem. There was something you try to avoid. That was spin glass, this kind of difficulty. Because for those kind of things, I know, probably, I'm not sure whether Huang was there, because also to my experience, there are many things get more promising and more fun when you turn sampling to optimization. But one thing I can, since you're asking for suggestions, one thing I'm not sure, probably you can take it also with a sort of grand of thought. So typically I fear those really rough energy landscape problems already cause lots of trouble in sampling, but once you turn that into optimization, it doesn't get easier. So if you need one suggest,
it does get easier.
Already?
No, I'm asking you. So what did you say? So if you turn a rough sampling problem into an optimization problem, generally you think it does get easier?
No, I don't think so. I think it's got even more difficult. So that's why I would suggest people try to at least avoid this one, and otherwise, that's
okay. Super interesting. Okay, thanks, Lei Wang. I told you we could fill up an hour, so everyone, let's thank Lei Wang again.
Yeah, thanks a lot.